Again, it's my pleasure to conclude the morning symposium today. And what I'd like to tell you about is some of our efforts, and I sort of colloquially call it using old for new, to imply that what we're going to be looking at is a juvenile disease, so not so much on the sort of adult onset side of the spectrum, but to look at a disease called muscular dystrophy. It's a neuro... the most prevalent neuromuscular degenerative disease out there. It's involved in one in sort of every 3,600 live male births in the United States. It has a very robust advocacy group. So one of the nice things about these patients, and also one of the tragic things, is that this nonsense mutation in a gene called dystrophin can be sort of overcome by a variety of different processes within muscle, either its own endogenous regeneration with satellite cells, compensation from proteins like utrophin, and what that eventually leads to is patients that succumb to the disease, say, in the third decade of life. So it can be a very tragic situation where you've got patients that sort of have a clock, if you will, and so we're trying to get a variety of therapies into those patients. And one of the biggest problems with this disease is that it affects this protein dystrophin that's 2.2 megabases. It has almost 80 different exons in it, so it makes it very difficult with all this splicing that goes on to be actually able to sort of target any good region of the protein and understand its function or to do any sort of gene therapy with it. And despite the fact that we know that most of the common mutations that occur in this protein end up altering the ability then to link together the actin cytoskeleton, sort of the business end of muscle, with the outside world in the extracellular matrix. And so we're sort of deleting the C-terminal part of the protein dystrophin and altering its ability then to transduce forces. So sort of as a side effect, if you will, of this disease is the fact that you get sort of significant fibrosis and muscle stiffening. So as shown in the lower left here, these are two different studies then indicating that you have altered sort of mechanical function of the muscle itself, and that's due to a variety of different reasons, one being the excess deposition of extracellular matrix proteins like collagens in this muscle. And so you can see sort of collagen one that gets deposited in between these muscle fibers, and that eventually then stiffens the muscle and causes it to degenerate and lose its function. Now, there are a variety of different clinical outcomes that people have looked at, but the gold standard by the FDA is the six-minute walking distance test. And so the data shown at the right is just sort of a comparison then of normal patients then where you and I can, say, walk about 500 meters or so in 6 minutes. Patients that are sort of high-functioning muscular dystrophy patients don't necessarily have that sort of change as a function of early progression of the disease, but once there's a severe onset, patients really begin to fail. So a variety of clinical trials then have been targeted at trying to sustain this population for as long as possible. But most of these treatments then simply go into managing or maintaining muscle function and are really not focused in on regeneration. I mentioned this idea of exon skipping, sort of trying to jump over where the mutation is or trying to boost dystrophin. But the thing that I'd like to point out is unfortunately, thanks to the government shutdown, we don't have the most accurate numbers. But right now, there really are no cell-based approaches to thinking about muscular dystrophy. So what I'd first like to present then is our data then looking at adult mesenchymal stem cells. So these are cells that have been characterized by the company Osiris Therapeutics back in the late 1990s. And the idea is that these have a distinct surface marker population that come out of the bone marrow, not hematopoietic, but in fact a slightly different niche. And they have the ability to go down a variety of different mesodermal lineages. Now, all these cells live in the context of a three-dimensional extracellular environment. And what I'd like to tell you about then is our ability to control these cells by the extracellular matrix and its intrinsic properties, which are many. So you can have matrix ligands, so differences in the composition, differences in the stiffness. So thinking about something that's as hard as that, or something that's way too soft. So my jokes aren't nearly as good as Larry's. But our first attempt to understand how these cells sort of interact with their microenvironment and how that environment can in part play a role in their differentiation was to look at these cells under conditions where they're attached to a gel that has a defined set of matrix properties like stiffness, so we can make things hard or soft. And the take-home message was just that these cells could then differentiate or at least become sort of the precursor cells to each one of these different lineages based off of the mechanical properties that we are presenting this to the cell. So bone relatively stiff, muscle sort of in between, fat and neurons then slightly softer. So from a regenerative perspective, wanting to get these cells and their ability to differentiate down a specific lineage, so we want to take cells as far as we can down this myogenic lineage. There are a variety of other cell types out there that are perhaps superior then to these bone marrow-derived stem cells, where we had done proof of concept work. And so I'd first point to the work of Amy Wager's lab at Harvard, where they showed that these what are called skeletal muscle progenitor cells, you can think of them as a satellite cell, were helping to regenerate muscle, and you could actually see some functional recovery. And from the work of Helen Blau's lab, we showed that these skeletal muscle progenitor cells could in fact be expanded in culture, but we wanted to take the position where we could look at adipose-derived stem cells. So this is a healthy sort of donor population. We're going to restrict it to female donors that are relatively young, so 20 to 40 years old, and look at their adipose-derived stem cells and see, do they have the same capabilities as these cells to differentiate, to engraft into tissues, and ultimately to regenerate function? And again, the sort of reason why we'd be most interested in these cells is because they have the advantage over, say, a bone marrow-derived stem cell or an SMP, that we can get these from a rapidly enlarging population, if you will, so we're growing ever obese. And in Southern California, we like to say, well, people can be somewhat vain, so they like to get rid of their fat. So it's sort of the best of both worlds, if you will. So as I mentioned, these adipose-derived stem cells had a property that was slightly different from the bone marrow-derived stem cells that we were working with, and that is the observation that they will, in fact, fuse together in culture. So if you drop the serum concentrations and play a few other tricks, you can get these cells to fuse together. The problem was that myoblast fusion is a relatively rare event with these adipose-derived stem cells when you're simply differentiating them by chemical means. So what Yusuf Choi did in the lab was to look at these adipose-derived stem cells, where he differentially labeled them either populations of green-labeled cells or red-labeled cells using a membrane dye, and he mixed those two together, and he noticed that if you do this with a bone marrow-derived stem cell, the red cell stays red, the green cell stays green, even if they're touching each other. That isn't the case with a control myoblast population or with our adipose-derived stem cells, so we got multinucleated cells that were yellow. Now, this was an indication that perhaps fusion occurred, but it wasn't definitive evidence, and so what we did to prove that was to look at the population, make sure that they are Ki-67 negative, so they're not proliferating at the moment that we look at these cells, but they have a continuous cytoskeletal network between these multinucleated cells. And most importantly, what we could do then is to trypsinize these cells and replate them into an environment that looked sort of dystrophic from the perspective of the extracellular matrix. So we could change stiffness, let's say, and make it look much more like the dystrophic fibrotic muscle that I was mentioning earlier. And we noted that the fusion rates of these cells didn't really change. But there was one important caveat to this, and I'd sort of say it's like the inverse Wall Street problem, that we care about this really rare, or not as rare, population of cells now, about 2% fusion as opposed to 0.2%. But we don't really like this 98% of the population that seems to transdifferentiate. When we put them into these more osteogenic-like matrices, they become RUNX2 positive, and that's absolutely what we don't want. So we want to get rid of those cells. So there are three really large sort of blocks, if you will, for us going forward to actually translate these cells into a therapy. And the first one, I'd like to touch on the first two today, and that would be that, are all adipose-derived stem cells equal? So we can get them from, say, visceral regions like with liposuction, as we were previously doing. We could also get them from a variety of other locations within the body, and we want to know whether or not those are all the same. we want to address issues of, say, plasticity as well. So are these cells going to transdifferentiate? Because that's really important in moving forward with any of these therapies. And so here's the aging pitch. So we were interested at first in relatively young donors. But a series of collaborations that we've had with Sam Ward and John Lane here at UCSD in orthopedics has interest us in the supraspinatus and infraspinatus muscles of the rotator cuff. And the reason for this is because rotator cuffs are commonly torn, so people go in and get revision surgeries to reattach the muscle or the tendon. And so we can look at these different MRI images and we can figure out exactly how diseased that patient is. And so what you're noting here is this is the supraspinatus and infraspinatus muscles, and what I'm pointing to with the blue arrow here is epimuscular fat. So this is fat that's now developed on top of the muscle itself. And if we were to take fat either from this region or from the subcutaneous sort of back fat, if you will, or from liposuctions with younger patients, what we notice is that they're dramatically different cell morphologies from these. Even though they're all adipose-derived stem cells, they express the same markers that you would expect them to. They double at dramatically different rates, and so they've got a lot of different properties about them. Most notably, they seem to have dramatically different origins, even though they're still fat. So there are sort of three different types of fat, white fat, brown fat, and a more recently characterized cell paper pointed us to this idea of beige fat. So a fat that is sort of somewhat metabolically active, but yet has is not necessarily from a muscle-like lineage, as is brown fat. And so as we induce these cells from a variety of different patients, either from our abdominal patients, from the back fat, or from the rotator cuff epimuscular fat, we notice a dramatically different lineage. So I'd point your attention then to here, where we're looking at sort of generic fat markers, as well as then our epimuscular fat from patients that had no tear. So these are sort of normal rotator cuffs. Maybe they had some bursitis, but that was about it. And so when they came into the clinic and we got their biopsies, then we noticed that they were preferentially becoming brown fat. Whereas if we took these cells from the torn cases, then they were preferentially becoming beige. And so that was an interesting observation to us, but what was more important was the fact that regardless of that tear state, there was a significant increase in the myogenic capacity of these cells, beyond what we ever found with our liposuction samples. So older patients, even though they're older, because we've taken them from the specific abdominal anatomical region that we are interested in, now are differentiating very robustly, and they're capable of fusion in co-culture. So this is a co-culture with C2C12 cells or with patient-matched cells, and the take-home message is that either you're looking at these green cells in panel A, or in D, you're looking at the acquisition then of this red signal, and you're getting fusion of these cells at a much higher rate when we're looking at the epimuscular fat in an aged population versus just, say, a visceral fat population in an older, in a younger population. But we come back to this idea that transdifferentiation of these cells is really a big problem for us. And so what's also been noted by Justin Cooper-White's lab in Queensland is the fact that these cells integrate a variety of cues together, both from the matrix as well as from the media and growth factor signaling. So what you're looking at here then are two cells that are grown on a variety of different matrix stiffnesses, if you will. So we're interested sort of in this middle region again around 9. And we're seeing the induction then of MyoD, a muscle transcription factor, on collagen 1-coated and fibronectin coated matrices. Whereas if you're using laminin 111 or collagen 4, we're not necessarily getting robust differentiation of these cells. And that's interesting from the perspective of what normal muscle makes. So this is mass spec data from our lab where we're looking at the expression of proteins in red here that are matrix proteins primarily associated with the disease state with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, whereas the green proteins down here are primarily expressed then in healthy muscle. And what you'll notice is that things like collagen 4 and laminin are preferentially expressed in normal muscle, whereas Decorin, a collagen cross-linking protein, and collagen 6s are expressed in the dystrophic case. And so we can confirm this with Alessandro Sacco's lab and show that this is, in fact, what we observe. So we want to better differentiate these cells using a much more complete environment. We also want to select these cells against those hyperproliferative cells. So we can use a drug called RSC, and we can get rid of some of those singly nucleated muscle fibers. Singly nucleated muscle cells, I should say. So when we're interested in injecting these cells into an animal model then of say muscular dystrophy, the first thing that we wanted to do was just make sure that they could engraft and actually form functioning muscle and make human dystrophin. And so we did the injections then into a TA muscle, so it's one of the hind limb muscles. And the take-home message is that you can get these cells to engraft, they can express human dystrophin despite being in older or younger patients or older or younger cells. We can get these cells to engraft, make human dystrophin, and we're still doing all the functional recovery assays to see whether or not these cells, these mice then are indeed more ambulatory because we've now rescued their expression of dystrophin with the appropriately full-length version of human dystrophin. So just to conclude then, what I'd really like to point out then is the fact that these ASCs confuse at higher rates when we're looking at matrix properties, but ultimately we need to put all these different stimuli together so that we can ensure that these cells fuse and are no longer plastic, especially if we're taking them from, say, a rotator cuff where these cells, given their origin and where they're sort of living in the body, are bathed in these muscle factors and are very myogenic. And so ultimately, we want to use these cells to engraft in these mouse models and show functional recovery. So I'd just like to thank those that, that helped do all this work, primarily all those highlighted in blue here. So Yusuk Choi is a postdoc who's now an assistant professor at the University of Sydney, as well as Gretchen Mayer, a postdoc who will be leaving us very shortly for her own lab at Washington University, as well as our collaborators, Merrick Dobke gets us all of our liposuction samples, so he loves dealing with fat and making people skinny. Sam Ward and John Lane then got us all of our rotator cuff samples, as well as lots of help from Alessandra's lab, as well as funding then from this San Diego Skeletal Muscle Center, Muscular Dystrophy Association, and a new investigator award, new innovator award from NIH. So, thank you very much.